You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about some of the legacy of Title IX, a history still being written, as this weekend brings the culmination of the first officially branded March Madness Women's NCAA Basketball Tournament. But now, ongoing talks between Ukraine and Russia have resumed. Over the weekend, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine would be willing to consider becoming a neutral state in order to end the Russian invasion. Ukrainian neutrality is something Russian President Vladimir Putin has long pushed for. But at the same time, Zelensky has stressed that Ukraine must remain sovereign, and he's criticized the U.S. and other Western nations for not doing enough. We're talking about the latest developments in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join us here, 1-800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. needs to send more military supplies and weapons to Ukraine? Should the U.S. not get too involved in what's happening? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us here at Central Time WPR. We're speaking today with Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He specializes in post-communist politics. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Molly. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us today to break this down. Now, before we talk about the ceasefire talks, let's talk a little bit about where U.S.-Ukrainian relations stand. And Zelensky has criticized the U.S. and Western Europe for not doing enough. What does he want at this point in time?
That's a good question, because in some ways we continue to hear how pleased Ukrainian officials are with the amount of military support that has come specifically from the United States, and we're also working with them on sharing intelligence information and things like that as well. Obviously, they had talked quite a bit about pushing the West, U.S. and Western Europe and the rest of NATO to do a no-fly zone over Ukraine, although that talk has seemed to it been decreasing in the last few days at least. But they would still like much more in terms of support and getting that support as quickly as possible to them, because in some ways, because of their military successes, they're actually using up a lot of the equipment pretty quickly that we have been sending them.
And now, over the weekend, President Biden spoke in Poland. And he made comments that the White House has since tried to walk back. Let's listen.
For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power.
So that was President Joe Biden speaking a little bit off the cuff there. Tell us what's happened since then, since he made that remark.
It's interesting because in the United States, a lot of people are just sort of saying there's a Biden being Biden moment, right, that he's known to do that. The problem with it is it does play into Putin's hands a bit in terms of giving him a PR kind of, talking point about the conflict that he has pitched to his own people, both with just a kind of complete fabrication about a genocide looming for ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine, but also really trying to pitch it as about the West really trying to weaken and undermine Russian security. And so when President Biden does say something like that, again, that can be a little useful to Putin in making that claim. I will say it is not great form. I think in general, we don't typically talk about leaders being removed in advance of it happening as at least a U.S. policy. Although I would remind people, too, that his slip up a little earlier when he called, Putin a war criminal, and initially the White House sort of tried to backtrack that. A couple days later, that was official U.S. policy, right, that we're considering him that, and the State Department says that. So it'll be interesting to see whether they try to keep kind of walking it forward a bit in the next few days, or whether they do just hope that it gets dropped and forgotten about.
Saying the quiet part out loud, I feel like, is
right.
So tell us, with these ongoing peace talks, what has come of them so far today?
So two things to note. One you had mentioned earlier, which is the increasing emphasis from the Ukrainian side on the openness to a neutral status for Ukraine that would mean not official membership in NATO, but also not being a part of Russia, obviously, either. And that's a little more complicated in some ways, in that there's, as there is with a lot of things related to this conflict, there's a sort of second piece to the story. And it's that he has also said, as part of that neutrality understanding, that there would be security guarantees for Ukraine that would include the U.S. and Europe essentially guaranteeing that Ukrainian sovereignty would be protected, which in practice sounds very much like what would happen if they were a NATO member.
Right.
So I think so it's kind of neutrality, but right. I mean, there's that second piece that's going to be the sticking point, and Russia will not accept any idea of a kind of security guarantee from Europe to protect Ukraine in the future as part of a deal, I don't think, because that's been such a focus for Putin as the, you know, one of the many justifications for this conflict is about NATO's encroachment through Eastern Europe and all the way, you know, with Ukraine on the table as a future member. What Putin sees as coming, you know, right up to the Ukrainian border even more than it already is with the Baltic states. So I think, again, the neutrality one is an interesting concept, and it is one that had been talked about briefly before the invasion. But again, in the case of Ukraine at this point, they aren't going to accept neutrality if Russia can just easily come in again with an invasion. The other interesting story kind of today is about the announcement from Russia that they are kind of pulling back a bit on activities around Kyiv and Chernihiv, which is a city in the far northern part of Ukraine. I think people are getting pretty excited about that in terms of thinking that might show that Russia is starting to back down. My take on that is actually that it is just acknowledging what has been happening on the ground, which is that Russia has been losing in the northern part of the country. They've lost territory to Ukraine around Kyiv, both to the east of Kyiv and to the west of Kyiv. So I think in some ways it's really just a kind of repositioning, regrouping strategy that may involve what they also said, which is they want to focus more on the far eastern part of the country and probably the southeastern part of the country rather than Kyiv. But again, that's as much as anything an acknowledgement, I think, that they just realized they were not going to be able to take Kyiv, maybe not even after, you know, weeks and weeks of fighting. They just might not be able to take it at all at this point.
So where does this leave the two sides in the conflict?
Well, again, I don't think we should expect it to end immediately. I mean, it's great that there are talks. That it is always good to have negotiations. You never know what's going to come out of them. So you always want to go through, even if it seems like you're going through the motions, you want to do that because it could be that some piece of something ends up, you know, working out as an agreement later. But the challenge for both Putin and Zelensky here is, what is their outcome that they're okay with that overlaps with the other ones? And I just don't see where that is right now for either of them. Putin can't pull back all the way to kind of where they were before the invasion, I don't think. And at this point, Ukraine's actually talking about that's not even enough for them. They want Crimea and the eastern, you know, parts of Donetsk and Luhansk back as well. So I don't see a lot of overlap there. But again, we'll see down the road. If Russia continues to take more losses, there may be a point at which either Putin is pressured to or just decides that it is better to withdraw and then just use his massive, you know, propaganda machine back in Russia to try to spin it as a win.
We're speaking with Professor Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor at the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, and we have a call for you. We are going to go to the phones and speak with George in Ashland. Good afternoon, George.
Good afternoon. I had two parts to my questions. One I would call Quebec and the Donbass, another one I call Hong Kong and Sevastopol. So firstly, would it be helpful if the Ukrainians would focus more on healing the cultural divisions between the Russian-speaking and Ukrainian-speaking populations of some of their districts, heal that cultural divide? And it reminds me of the separatist movement of Quebec years ago, French-speaking culture versus English-speaking culture. So would that be helpful? The second question is, Hong Kong and Sevastopol, doesn't strike me that the Russian military will ever give up Sevastopol. So why can't Ukrainians lease it to the Russians for like 500 years, kind of like the British leased Hong Kong for the Chinese, and therefore the Ukrainians don't give up their sovereignty, but they've made a deal that maybe works.
All right. Thanks for the call, George. Lowell.
So, George, those are both really interesting questions. I'm going to start with the second one. I think it's the quicker answer, which is that I would expect there would be some kind of agreement like that in any outcome that gives Ukraine territory back that Russia has seized. It's actually hard to imagine easily, at least, that Russia gives up Crimea, even if things continue to go really badly with the conflict. Crimea has actually been brought into the Russian political system as a republic within the Russian Federation. So that's a hard one to see. But if it were, I would agree that they would absolutely push for Sevastopol to be a military base with Russians there. And other countries around Russia have done that kind of agreement where they've allowed Russian troops to remain. So I think that does make some sense. The analogy with Quebec and the far east of Ukraine is an interesting one. I think one of the things that in my work and a lot of others who've done a lot of work with survey data in Ukraine in the last few years have noticed is that the point that's raised about sort of finding a place for the Russian language is still important, and those are important talks to have. But one of the things we've been seeing is that line in Ukraine between the people who sort of look toward Russia as a place that they're feeling very connected and attached to and those who look to Europe, that line has moved eastward dramatically, and it did that after 2014, and it's continuing to do that, so that in the surveys that we've done, one of the things we've seen is a lot fewer people who declare that they are ethnically Russian or say that they are Russian-only speaking, and then, in fact, a lot of people are now saying they speak both languages or even saying they're kind of Russian and Ukrainian, not just Russian, in the eastern part of the country. So I think that's always going to be an issue about, you know, debates about street signs and what language they're in schools and what language that should be the language of instruction and things like that. And those talks will continue in eastern Ukraine. But again, I think that one of the things we have to acknowledge is, and one of the other people who work on general population attitudes in Ukraine put it, that Ukraine has become much more Ukrainian. And by that, he means the language has been taken up more in the east than it used to be. And there's a also pretty strong emerging sense of a kind of overarching Ukrainian civic national identity that had been forming, but again, sped up after 2014, and I think is really speeding up now, partly because, and it's one of the stranger parts of this conflict, that the areas that the Russian troops have attacked in some ways most forcefully have been in a lot of ways the most ethnically Russian or at least Russian-speaking parts of the country.
Right, right. Lowell Barrington is associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. We are speaking about Ukraine. What do you want to know about what's happening in Ukraine right now? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us, ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're speaking with Marquette University political scientist Lowell Barrington about what's happening in the Ukraine-Russia conflict. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-642-1234. And Lowell, I want to go to the phones right now. I want to speak with Marcus in Milwaukee with a question that, picking up on something you said earlier about potential for other alliances with Ukraine. Good afternoon, Marcus.
Hi. Hi, Professor Barrington. So my question, I guess that what I'm wondering is, why doesn't the U.S. look to perhaps like try and set up some sort of other system of alliance kind of similar to how we have NATO, except that it would consist of countries more like Norway, Sweden, and Finland, like that type of model, since the Russians already seem to be okay with them not being a part of NATO, but having some sort of mutual assistance pack, you know, if they were to be invaded, and see if we couldn't roll Ukraine into that so that it's kind of like a regional group with similar interests. So that way it can kind of sidestep the NATO issue. And it's also something that apparently the Russians seem to have been okay with thus far. So why not try and create some other, you know, northern North Atlantic treaty organization or something? I don't know what you call it. But
thanks, Marcus.
That's a great question. I think part of the answer there is that there also has to be an incentive for those other countries. And if you are Finland and Sweden, for example, the idea that you would want to get into an agreement to guarantee that you would intervene against Russia if it attacked Ukraine again in the future seems to be something that it would be not necessarily in their interest to do, because they would potentially be drawn into a significant conflict that they, you know, may struggle with. So I like the idea. I think in practice, it's finding the incentives for the other countries. The second quick piece, though, is that there is at least a non-trivial chance that both Finland and Sweden will be NATO members down the road. I think that on the long list of things that Putin's invasion of Ukraine has done is really made it obvious to Europe how important and relevant NATO is. And I think it is, I mean, in both countries it's being talked about, I think it's quite likely that they will pursue NATO membership actually in Finland and Sweden. And I think that at this point in time, at least, there's no reason to think of Ukraine being able to join NATO anytime soon, just because they have been so destabilized. And the invasion has done one thing for Putin, which is to show that he can, in fact, destabilize Ukraine if they were to ever, think about getting serious again about a NATO membership.
Which arguably was the goal, one of the goals.
Right, and that way he's won, right? He won in taking NATO membership for Ukraine off the table. That is not going to be anything that's going to happen in the near future. On the other hand, again, there is the tally sheet. You know, that's one of his only wins, right? And then there's this huge number of things that have been really important losses for him in this that I don't think, he's happy with the way that the balance on the two sides of that tally sheet go.
Yeah. I want to go back to the phones. We have a caller, Gary, in Madison with a question about refugees and the visa process. Good afternoon, Gary.
Good afternoon. My question is about the 100,000 visas that President Biden has announced that he's going to make available to Ukrainian refugees. But if you go to the State Department website, number one, the embassy in Kiev is closed. Number two, you can't apply for a refugee or that visa in the embassy in Warsaw. You have to go to Frankfurt, Germany to apply for those visas. So my question is the administration really sincere about this, or is this just public relations posturing?
So, Gary, I think that they are sincere. Some of those details may be able to get worked out down the road. It may be that we could end up doing this in Poland instead of Germany. But there are so many refugees right now that, in fact, a large number of them will end up making their way to Germany. There's actually reports of Ukrainian refugees showing up at the southern border in Mexico and requesting to become part of that process already. That's another way we might think about it. They may find other ways to try to get closer to the United States. But in the meantime, again, Germany is also bracing for the number of refugees that have gone into Poland, for example. They can't all stay in Poland. Poland can't handle that many people, and even in some ways Hungary and Romania are looking to send some of those refugees farther west. So I think the part of the process of being an alliance is, yes, we have to take seriously the idea that we are going to accept refugees, that if we don't do that and we get a refugee crisis in Europe, that's one of the ways that this really impressive unity that's been developed between the United States and Western Europe could start breaking down, as if there's just a massive refugee humanitarian crisis, and we're not playing a role to help that.
Mm-hmm. Good question. When we've got calls are pouring in, I want to take next Mike from Waukesha. Good afternoon.
Hi,
Mike.
Hello, good afternoon. So, social media, there's a buzz going around, and there's these foolish questions, I think. It asks, would this have happened under President Trump's watch? And in fact, I think President Trump partially caused this, because when he tried to back us away from NATO, this emboldened Putin. The other thing is I think it was going to happen anyway. There probably would have been less bloodshed, but then either way, then Russia would have tried to get what it wanted. I just wonder what your guest comments are. Thank you.
Thanks. Lowell.
Well, Mike, I agree with you to an extent in that I think one of the things that Putin saw going into this was at least he believed that Europe and the United States would not be united in a response. And that was partly because of how bad relations had become between the United States and Europe leading up to 2020. But at the same time, I also want to say that the timing also relates to the idea that since President Biden has been in office, that there was renewed talk of Ukraine becoming a NATO member. So I don't want to say it's only a problem prior to the administration, I shouldn't say problem, but it's not just a cause of the bad relations in the past. It's a combination of the fact that Putin believed that Europe would be would not be able to be united. If I told people before the war that, we're going to help figure out how to bring Germany, France, and the UK together along with us to bring all these countries together, and on top of that, you know, Switzerland is going to impose economic sanctions. I mean, just the number of things that have been able to happen in the United response have been really impressive. But again, that took a lot of work, because where Mike is right is that there was significant damage done to our relations with Europe in the previous administration. And I think that we need to acknowledge the Biden administration has done a very effective job at putting together this this alliance right now in terms of its economic responses and military support for Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Unprecedented. Well, Lowell, we're almost out of time, but I would love to hear what you are watching for out of these peace talks.
Well, I don't think I'm very optimistic about them, I guess is what I would say. They're important. Again, I think they should be happening, and anytime you get sides together, it's a good thing. But the real question again is what are the off ramps that Putin could find acceptable that Zelensky also can accept and would be politically possible in Ukraine? And that's the really tricky part here, is that Zelensky has done this amazing job of rallying the Ukrainian people, but he's done it by the idea that we're not going to surrender an inch of this territory. And so for him now to take that step toward a deal that might involve, in fact, acknowledging that Russia is going to control territory in Ukraine, that's going to be very difficult for him to do. But for Putin, there's no real incentive for him to withdraw, even with the losses they're taking, unless there's something he can point to as a territorial or some kind of situation that was better than it was when the invasion started. So I think that's one thing to look for, is just, are there any opportunities where you see something that kind of overlaps between the two positions? The only other thing to keep an eye on is whether we start seeing cracks within the Russian government and you start seeing more criticism or more acknowledgement of the number of losses. But I think it's a slightly conservative estimate, but there are likely at least 15,000 Russian troops that have been killed so far in a month in this conflict. That is, you know, 500 a day. It's an incredible number of losses. And that, along with the economic problems, will certainly put at least some pressure on Putin going forward.
Well, Lowell Barrington, we will be watching. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Molly.
We've been speaking with Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Lee Rayburn talks to the investigative journalist and filmmakers behind the new Frontline documentary. It's called Plot to Overturn the Election. That's coming up tomorrow morning on The Morning Show at 7. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up at 6 on 1A+, does America have a free speech problem? Jen White and her guests look at where the debate stands over shaming, shunning, and the right to speak freely. Plus, hear 1A's new series, In Case You Missed It. That's today at 6. But next, players from Stanford, South Carolina, Louisville, and UConn women's college basketball teams are arriving in Minneapolis today after securing their spots as the final four squads competing in the NCAA National Championship this weekend. While the term March Madness has long been associated with the men's college tournament, this is the first time the women have also been able to use this well-known branding. It's fitting, given this year is the 50th anniversary of Title IX, the law that, at least by design, sought to remove sex-based obstacles to being able to learn and work as we choose. And we'd love to hear from you. What does Title IX mean to you? Do you think we have made progress in this area? Do you remember what it was like before? 1-800-642-1234. Email us ideas@wpr.org. To reflect on this moment in history, we're joined by Mary Jo Kane. She's Professor Emerita at the School of Kinesiology, the University of Minnesota. She's also the Director Emerita of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport. Mary Jo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Molly. I am delighted to be here on what I know will be a very exciting week in the Twin Cities.
Yeah, so tell us what the mood is like there in Minneapolis.
Well, it's been pretty crazy. We're quite proud. You know, it's a very competitive bid to try to get the Final Four at all. And the fact that we found out that we not only got the Final Four, but that the University of Minnesota would be hosting the Final Four in the 50th anniversary of Title IX, it's been pretty crazy. And then I'm assuming many of your listeners last night, and maybe you did too, Molly, watched the double overtime thriller between UConn and the University of North Carolina, UNC, North Carolina State. And I bring that up only because the clutch player of the game was Paige Beckers, who is from Hopkins, Minnesota. So hometown girl makes good and comes back. And I can assure you that ESPN, who is carrying the Final Four, couldn't be more thrilled to have great matchups with great superstars and great programs and coaches. I mean, you couldn't have a better lineup than UConn against the defending champion Stanford in the kickoff game Friday night.
Well, and I want to talk a little bit about how we got here. And one of the things that stood out to me in thinking about this is the situation that we were in last year. So I want to play a short clip. A player from the Oregon women's team, Sedona Prince, posting a video to TikTok comparing the tournament weight rooms between the men and the women. Here's an excerpt from that video.
So for the NCAA March Madness, the biggest tournament in college basketball for women, this is our weight room. Let me show y'all the men's weight room. Now, when pictures of our weight room got released versus the men's, the NCAA came out with a statement saying that it wasn't money, it was space that was a problem. Let me show y'all something else. Here's our practice court, right? And then here's that weight room. And then here's all this extra space. If you aren't upset about this problem, then you're a part of it.
Now, on the video, for the folks that remember, there were several seconds where she was panning the phone camera around a men's gym full of weights and equipments as compared to the women's gym, which was just this small stack of hand weights and a few yoga mats. What impact do you think that video, Prince's video, had on this event?
Well, it was invaluable. And it was another data point in when you started out, Molly, by asking me, how did we get here? One of the things that I talk about in terms of how far we've come as we approach the second generation of post-Title IX is that unlike I was a young tomboy who grew up in central Illinois in the 50s and 60s, where there were no sports for me. And what Title IX did was change the calculation totally, so that young women today, for the first time in our history, grow up with a sense of entitlement to sports. They're not just happy to be there. They are outraged when they see that they are being treated differently. And that data point, which frankly shamed, which is really hard to do, some of your listeners may know, it's really hard to shame and embarrass the NCAA. There was such a backlash to the unequal treatment that the situation was immediately resolved, and the NCAA has fallen all over itself, letting everybody know as we approach this year's March Madness that everything is equal, equal, equal. It's really similar to what happened with Megan Rapinoe and the Women's World Cup soccer team.
Yes.
When they were used the World Cup soccer games as a way to argue for pay equity and bring that issue to the fore. Because women today, as I said, feel a sense of entitlement, and that has never happened, and it wouldn't have happened without Title IX.
But are things equal today?
No. In a word, no. But you always, when I'm asked that question, Molly, what I think about is, well, what is our baseline of comparison? And this is not to say that women should not continue to push for equality any more than people shouldn't continue to push for any kind of equality, racial equality, social justice in all realms. But if your baseline of comparison is where we were before Title IX, our cup runneth over. Because as I said, for young girls like me, there were no teams, let alone scholarships. And today, it wouldn't occur to any young girl, and many of the women that I taught as Division I athletes at the University of Minnesota, it would never occur to them that if they wanted to play and they were good enough and they were willing to pay the price, that an opportunity would not be there. So that's been resolved. That's sort of settled law, if you will. But no, women still don't get anywhere near the treatment, the media coverage, and the money that the men do. But that's changing with each generation.
What do you see as the next frontier? I mean, as you mentioned, the law may be there, but the resources don't necessarily follow. And these are still issues that are litigated over. I mean, as you mentioned, the U.S. women's soccer team suing over. So what's the next frontier here?
I think the next big frontier will be the issues around trans athletes and how that's going to play out. And I was talking to Tim, your producer, before I came on, and he just told me that the state legislature in Utah overrode the governor's veto of the trans law that will ban trans athletes from participating throughout the state. And the very first thing that I said to him was, and I presume that a lawsuit will soon follow. So I think that we're going to have a lot of that happening. And, you know, again, this is going to be a brave new world. It is a little bit ironic, Molly, as I've thought about this issue quite a bit over the last few weeks, especially with Leah Thompson, the trans woman swimmer being in the news who swims for Penn. You know, the whole point of Title IX was to increase opportunities for women. And now I think we're going to have a bunch of lawsuits trying to actually prevent trans women from participating with women. So that seems to be quite an ironic twist, and certainly something that lawmakers in 1972 could never have envisioned. But I think that's the next sort of brave new world, if you will, where we're going.
So how do you see Title IX being used in these lawsuits?
Well, the whole point, and again, I want to just stress that I'm not a lawyer or a legal scholar, but as I'm seeing this play out and people sort of jockeying for positions, on the one hand, you have trans athletes and their advocates saying, this is all about equity, and I should have the right and the opportunity to participate because sports is all about inclusion. And then you have the other side with, again, to me, ironically, women athletes saying, no, we want to, not all women athletes, I want to be really clear about that, but certainly a sizable number of female athletes and their advocates who are now starting to talk about lawsuits to try to ban trans women from participating. I think it's going to get played out in the courts. It's certainly going to get played out in the various voices that are, frankly, taking up sides. And I don't have any idea where this is headed. Maybe some of your listeners do.
Well, and we hope to hear from them. We're talking with Mary Jo Kane, Professor Emerita at the School of Kinesiology, the University of Minnesota, talking about the Title IX impacts on the weekend's Final Four of the NCAA Women's Basketball Championship Tournament. We want to hear what you think. 1-800-642-1234. Did you participate in women's sports at any level? What was your experience like? Did you give much thought to Title IX? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stenson for Rob Ferret. We're speaking with Title IX expert Mary Jo Kane, Professor Emerita at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about the history, the impact, the future of Title IX and women's sports. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Well, Mary Jo, you were starting to unpack the issue of transgender athletes and fairness in competition. You mentioned you're not a lawyer. I understand that, but how do you see this conversation playing out? As we've seen, you know, legislatures across the country putting forth legislation to try to curtail opportunities or restrict athletes from participating. What are you looking at when you watch these debates?
Well, I'm watching what the various constituencies and advocacy groups, including women athletes, are talking about. At the risk of being a little political here, you're right to say that a number of states are now taking up legislation. I think there's going to be a strong correlation between the states that do that and how conservative and frankly Republican-controlled states those are. One fear that I have is that trans athletes and this whole issue will become a cudgel for the right to frankly try to make trans athletes the boogeymen and women that they are not. Even though I do think that there are very legitimate, personally think there are very legitimate questions about fairness and equity. We are in, as I said, a brave new world. The science is by no means set. And I think that the sort of key takeaway for me is what we're trying to do here, Molly, is really find the sweet spot, if you will, between two very important competing interests. On the one hand, and nobody knows this more than those who care about women's sports, we want to be inclusive and diverse and have sports be a playground, if you will, for opportunity, not just about sports, but what sports can do for you. On the other hand, sports, especially at elite levels, is all about fairness in competition. And if one person is seen to have a competitive advantage biologically or physiologically, then is that fair? And that's where that's where the rubber will hit the road here in terms of how this will ultimately be decided. And I quite frankly think it might even be decided at the federal level, mm-hmm. because the stakes are so high, and to have a uniform standard of participation.
Mm-hmm.
But if anybody says they know where this going, they know where this is going, I think they're being disingenuous, because, as I said before, we are in a brave new world that nobody anticipated.
It's moving fast.
Yes, very fast.
So I want to go to the phones. We've got calls coming in for you, and I want to go first to Shauna, where we've got Maddie on the line. Good afternoon.
Hi. Glad you could take my call.
What's on your mind?
I guess I would have to say that God bless Title IX should probably be on an epitaph for many of the people who went through that era. I went to high school where there were no women's sports. There was something called GAA, Girls Athletic Association, and we would have such an exciting Saturday if we had a play day at one of the colleges. So then I went to college, and I thought I'd died and gone to heaven because there was women's sports. I took the job in Shawano in 1965. We had no women's, 1969. We had no women's sports, and it was like pulling teeth to get that to happen, and it did gradually. I think one of the big turnarounds was in 1973-74. Our volleyball team won the very first state championship of Wisconsin. And when we were coming back to Shawano, except for the parents, there were no cars in the parking lot or anything like that.
Yeah.
In 1988, we were fortunate enough to win it again. And the amount of support had changed drastically. A 47-car caravan from Bondwell. The parking lot was full. The gym was full. We had gained a tremendous amount of respect and reputation.
Maddie, thank you. Thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. And, you know, I imagine, Mary Jo Cane, that you have heard so many stories like this from women across the country throughout your work.
Oh, forever and ever and ever. And I just as Maddie began her comment with God bless Title IX, I would like to say God bless Maddie and all of the women who came before. You could just hear the excitement in her voice because it shows so many women who wanted to play sports, who love sports, and who care deeply about sports. And the great thing about Title IX, Molly, is that after, again, decades of being told that girls didn't want to play sports, and even if they did, they wouldn't be any good, the thing that was great about Title IX is that we built them ballparks and playing fields all over this country, and sometimes women like Maddie had to, like, break the doors down. But we're here, we're in unprecedented numbers, and I would urge Maddie and anybody else who wants to drive over to Twin Cities this weekend, it's a sellout. But maybe you can get a ticket on the street. But there is enormous interest, And as I said, God bless Maddie and all those people in Wisconsin who paved the way for all of us.
Well, I want to go back to the phones now. We've got Elizabeth joining us from Madison. Good afternoon.
Hi, Molly. First-time caller, long-time listener, and I grew up with Title IX, so I'm really grateful to Mary Jo and all the women who fought for this, and I love sports. I'm calling because I want to know who you're picking to win the Final Four, Mary Jo, and are you excited about Dawn Staley?
Oh, my God. Don, you want to talk about a legend. Elizabeth, if you don't mind, I probably should take the fifth on who I think will win. But I don't know. Did you watch the game last night between the University of Connecticut and NC State that went into double overtime? I mean, I don't know. Here's what
amazing.
I think. Say it again.
It was amazing.
And Paige Becker, yeah. Sorry to be a homer here, Elizabeth, but Paige Beckers is from right outside the Twin Cities. So if you're a fan of women's sports and women's basketball in particular, Elizabeth, which you clearly are, you could not ask for a better lineup. I mean, think about this. Tara Vanderveer and the defending champions Stanford against Gino Auriemma and Paige Beckers. And then speaking of Dawn Staley, right? Iconic coach who brought South Carolina out of nowhere. And then Louisville, who's been there. I don't know. But Elizabeth, at the risk of being, I don't know, who are you picking? Come on.
It's hard because I like a dynasty, but I also like the underdog.
Yep.
Which leaves you with what, Louisville? So, I don't know. It's one of those things where I don't care who wins because there is just such joy watching people play.
Yes. Joy is absolutely right. And you are talking about some enormously talented women and coaches and legends and traditions. And again, we would not be here without Title IX. And I couldn't be more proud and lucky and filled with gratitude that the Final Four is here this weekend.
And I want to squeak in one last call. We've got Becky on the line from Beaver Dam. Becky, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, what's on your mind?
Well, hey, I just wanted to give a little bit of feedback also on Title IX and how important that is to me, I guess. And having grown up, hearing I was involved in sports and a lot of basketball, volleyball, softball, and track and such, but my mom would talk often about she played basketball when she was growing up and would talk about how, you know, the girls could only run half court because they didn't feel that girls could run full court at that time. And so it kind of always stuck in my mind and yes. How I appreciated the opportunities that I had. And I thought my high school coach did a great job where, in high school, he brought in graduated players and would
Becky,
talk to them. And
I so hate to do this, but we are up against the clock, and I want to get Mary Jo to respond to you. So, Mary Jo, we've just got a minute left.
And I'll try to be obviously brief. But, Becky, again, I want to thank you and for talking about your mother and for all of the ways in which Title IX has made such a difference over the generations, Molly. And as I am asked, as I often am, as we approach the 50th anniversary of Title IX, and I am sure this is true about the great state of Wisconsin and the women who have called in have made that clear. And this is what the impact of Title IX has really been. And that is, in two generations, we've gone from young girls like me and Maddie and Elizabeth all over this country, hoping that there is a team, to young girls all over this country today, hoping that they make the team. And that's the
yes.
difference because of Title IX.
Thank you, Mary Jo Kane. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. And again, thank you for inviting me, and go Final Four.
Mary Jo Kane, Professor Emerita at the School of Kinesiology at the University of Minnesota. We were speaking about legacy of Title IX and women's sports today.